For KPFK, November 24th, 2013, I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. All right, everybody, welcome to the show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio here every Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. You can find my full interview archive at scotthorton.org. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. This morning's guest is Nima Shirazi. He writes the great blog Why to Sleep in America at whytosleepinamerica.com. And he's an editor at mufta.org. That's M-U-F-T-A-H. org. Welcome back to the show. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks so much for having me, Scott.
Hey, congratulations, celebrations. They did it. The Democrats actually signed the deal with the Iranians.
Yeah, indeed. It's been a fascinating number of days. I know a lot of reporters who were in the Intercontinental Hotel in Geneva waiting for these talks to get done and for some news to be reported, and I know that they were working very hard, and there was finally something to report late on this Saturday night.
Yeah, I saw Retreta was saying at one point he kind of had a negative attitude. He's hearing negative things, but then he says that, wait a minute, this is going way too late into the night for them to... They obviously think they really have a deal at hand here, or
yeah,
they'd have gone home by now.
There was a period, I think you're absolutely right, it really kind of started to lag for a period. It looked like there was going to be a deal, like there was going to be an announcement earlier in the day, today, on Saturday. The foreign ministers of all seven countries that were involved were there in Geneva. That's John Kerry and Haig and Fabius and Zarif and Lavrov and everyone else. So it was really something to see, and I think that everyone was really expecting something earlier in the day. And then as the talks dragged on and there was nothing to report, I think people started becoming a little wary of what was actually going on. But for my part, I think the longer things took and the less that we heard was actually a really good sign. It meant that there was actually real diplomacy going on behind those closed doors, and that those foreign ministers were really trying to get something done. Obviously, people are going to have certain negative and also positive reactions to what the final result was. There's plenty to talk about. There's plenty unresolved issues, of course. There's plenty of apprehension. There's plenty of very negative, ridiculous reactions from obvious sectors, which I'm sure we can get into a little later. But generally, something very good came out of this. If nothing else, it proved that diplomacy can work. It pretty much guaranteed that war is off the table for any foreseeable future, if not forever, in terms of attacks on Iran. There's no way, I believe, Israel would unilaterally attack Iran after a deal has been signed with five nuclear powers, the five permanent members of the Security Council, as well as Germany. There's no way that this can be undermined unilaterally by Israel. Obviously, I have no illusions as to what Israel is capable of doing, and they have very little regard for international law or diplomacy, but I think we're a bit beyond that now, and it proves a number of things correct that anti-war folks have been saying for a very long time. It pretty much guarantees that we won't see the end to certain talking points, such as that sanctions worked. However, if you actually look at what the deal is and how all this was resolved and where it's moving forward, it really shows that sanctions really did not work in this case, and that they were clearly just a punitive measure that wound up hurting Iranian people and had no bearing on the outcome of any of this.
Well, go ahead and prove your case there.
Well, for one, the contours of the deal are actually very reminiscent of positions that Iran has been promoting, offers and proposals that they've been putting forward to the same group of countries virtually for the past decade. So since 2003, and then more often in 2005, 2006, and onward, that effectively Iran has been putting together many of the very same proposals for quite some time in terms of capping enrichment to certain levels far below weapons grade, in terms of halting the number of centrifuges they have operating at any given time, and increasing inspections, increasing transparency, stuff like that. Iran has really been proposing this for an extremely long time.
So the sanctions really have just served as a delay, and it's just let the Iranians build up a lot more to negotiate away.
Precisely right. I mean, what we've been hearing, kind of a common little soundbite of the past few days, has been that a decade ago, when these very same issues were effectively being discussed, Iran had fewer than 3,000 centrifuges spinning. They were not enriching uranium at any gigantic, gigantic levels. They were enriching to levels far below 20% even, which is not even weapons grade. It's basically for the use of in medical research reactors for medical isotopes. So at the time they were enriching to about 3.5%, which they still are, but 3.5%, which is good only for nuclear reactor fuel, having nothing to do with weapons production. And now, a decade later, after all of these sanctions, international, multilateral, unilateral, all of these sanctions have been heaped upon Iran and the people of Iran. And what do these people have to show for it? Well, Iran has over 19,000 centrifuges spinning. They enrich to just under 20% uranium, and they have facilities that are operational and safeguarded that didn't even exist 10 years ago. So if we look at some of the elements of the deal, Iran is committed to effectively halt enrichment above 5%. So that means that, you know, they will no longer operate their centrifuges that enrich to nearly 20% for the Tehran Research Reactor, which is the medical facility. They have committed to neutralize their stockpile of that higher enriched uranium. It's still low enriched uranium, according to IAEA safeguards and nomenclature. But it is obviously higher enriched than the 3.5%. And so what they're going to do with that is basically convert that to a form of enriched uranium, which cannot be further reprocessed towards weapons grade, which they've never done in the past anyway. But they will basically preclude any diversion of this higher 19.75% enriched uranium, which is a really big deal. We've been hearing for quite some time now by alarmists such as David Albright, who we have talked about in the past, and Israeli officials, members of Congress, all sorts of naysayers, that this 20% enriched uranium, nearly 20% enriched uranium, is a major proliferation risk. It's just a stone's throw away from weapons grade. Obviously, these centrifuges need to be completely refigured, and they wouldn't be able to do it without the IAEA inspectors readily knowing that was happening. But hey, whatever. Either way, this has been kind of noted as a real. Risk this 20% enriched uranium. So now, by taking that out of the equation completely, a lot of the hysteria over Iran's intentions and potential really kind of go away. Obviously, I don't think they will go away. I think we will keep hearing about things from these same people that the deal doesn't go far enough, that with any capacity to enrich any uranium to any enrichment levels whatsoever will still pose this gigantic threat that obviously doesn't actually exist, but we're supposed to think it exists. But either way, if you actually look at this deal on paper, it goes a long way to dispelling a lot of these myths.
Disagree with me if you like, but it seems to me very obvious that a conversation went on in Iran where they said, look, we never were making bombs, we're not making bombs, we've had our hands up, but let's just go ahead and bend over and let them do the strip search. Who cares? It all, you know, even if they don't have a warrant, at least that'll keep us from, you know, protect us from the no-knock raid. So come on in, guys, and look around. There's nothing to see. They've completely bent over for the Americans' demands here, and they're getting some sanctions relief in return.
I will push back on that just a little bit. So the additional protocol and code 3.1, the modified code, that is not yet part of this deal. I think that will be at a later stage. There are elements of those protocols which are evident here in this current deal. But in terms of doing things that have been long demanded of Iran that go far that fall far outside of their safeguards agreement, such as the IAEA gaining access to the Parchin medical military complex. That is not part of this deal. So. That is yet another issue which I'm sure will factor into future negotiations. But it's not like they're opening everything that has been demanded of them illegally. That's true. They're being very, very accommodating, and they're not even getting all that much in return. So,
I mean, they say uranium mines, the centrifuge facilities where they make them, where, mm-hmm. you know, this, and they do say modified code 3.1, right? What am I missing there?
Yeah, no. That's certainly true. That covers basically whenever Iran, let's say, decides to build a new facility, a new nuclear facility, based on that decision, not even once construction starts, not even as it gets 180 days away from actually introducing nuclear material to those sites after construction is complete and it's ready to be operated. Not even that, just the basic decision of constructing new facilities, that decision would then be announced to the IAEA. So, no, you're absolutely right on that.
See, I guess I'm sorry for overstating it, because you're right.
Oh, no,
I mean, there's
absolutely.
Not every single thing is covered in here. Obviously, this is just the preliminary agreement, whatever. But my attitude has been that their attitude has been, let's just put our hands up and cry, don't shoot, and hope the rest of the world can hear us loud enough, because... Again, they never were making nukes in the first place. They never tried to enrich a single molecule of uranium hexafluoride up to 90% purity, or 94 really is what's required for a bomb. It never was a thing. So where the North Koreans said, you can beat us over the head so much and we'll go ahead and say screw you and make nukes, the Iranians took a different decision way back 10 years ago and said, let's just keep our hands up and hope that the guaranteed non-diversion of our material on paper in every report will be enough to keep the American bombers at bay. And here, they're just going even further. So it may not be like they're willing to slit their own throat, but they're certainly pulling their pants down.
No, certainly. I mean, they are going very, very far. You are absolutely right. They are, not necessarily dismantling cascades, but they are, rendering them inoperable. They are limiting even the centrifuge production that they currently have going on. They're going to limit that. So it only basically replaces damaged machines, and they can't even use 6 months down the line. I mean, it's really interesting stuff. They're, promising not to construct additional enrichment facilities or to install any newer centrifuges that they have. Beyond this, they're even saying that the current stockpile of low-enriched uranium, the 3.5% stockpile, which is, again, only good to fuel nuclear reactors, have no weapons capability whatsoever. They are agreeing to effectively halt the growth of that stockpile completely over the course of 6 months. So, while it may grow a little bit in 6 months, by the end of the agreed to 6 month period, it needs to be back down to the current levels of where it is right now. So, I mean, they are really accepting extreme limits. Beyond this, we haven't even spoken about the reactor at Arak, which was a sticking point a couple weeks ago when talks kind of broke apart without a agreement. I mean, it's pretty much stopping it in its tracks. I mean, the Iraq facility, there are two separate facilities present at that place, very, very close to one another. There's a heavy water production plant, which is not a nuclear facility. It just basically makes heavy water, which then it's used as a moderator in a nuclear reactor. So then basically across the street is this half-built nuclear reactor, which uses this heavy water as a moderator. And by using heavy water as a moderator, you effectively can use non-enriched uranium, so just like basic, like raw uranium, as the reactor fuel, because you have this heavy water as a moderator. It kind of changes it. So whereas the Boucher reactor uses light water, which is just regular water. Using light water, you need, you know, enriched uranium to make it work. This one you don't, so then the waste fuel that is produced has a certain percent of that is plutonium. And then that plutonium can be extracted from this byproduct of the reactor fuel after it's used. And once that's extracted, it needs to be reprocessed, and then it can easily be made into weapons-grade plutonium for a bomb.
Now, however, by the way, even extracting it means you got to turn the thing off for probably half a year or a year and let it
exactly.
cool a bit.
It takes about
and then you
got to
get the Russians up and take the lid off.
Usable.
Yeah.
Plus, on top of that, Iran does not even have a reprocessing plant. So the whole alarmism over this reactor, which again is half built, it's not even going to be ready for months and months and months and months, if not a year. After that, it would take yet another year to even acquire the amount of waste product that would even be usable to extract plutonium to then reprocess for one single bomb. So this whole thing is this big hype about this facility. But nevertheless, again, as you've said, what Iran is now willing to do with this facility is to not only not start it up within this period, it's not going to put any fuel into it. What it's going to do is it's even going to halt the production of fuel for it. And again, it's under construction. It is non-operational. But even so, they're going to halt the production. They're not going to test any fuel for it. They're not going to install any additional reactor components for it in the meantime. So it'll just sit there as is. And they're not going to construct a facility capable of reprocessing. So what we see here is Iran really going the extra mile.
Right, absolutely. All right. Now, I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm talking with Nima Shirazi, and we're celebrating the Iran deal that would never come and finally came. They did. It's just the interim deal. It's not the final deal, and there's still plenty to be worked out. And I guess that leads to the question of whether you think it's possible for the Israelis to screw this up now, or we really have made that first step forward that we can't go back from.
I think this is a huge step forward. I think we will see in the coming days and weeks Israeli officials as well as their buddies in Congress and obviously lobbying efforts in D.C. try really hard to undermine this deal and to sell it as some sort of appeasement, which we hear so often on the part of the Obama administration. But honestly, I think it's going to be hard to tear apart.
Yeah, I think so, too. It's sort of, and now, so then that leads to the question of, you know, bigger picture, what this means for the future of the region. I could even anticipate maybe worse chaos in the sense of, you know, maybe the Saudis will decide to dump a bunch of money into the Sunni insurgencies in Iraq and Syria and, you know, and then provoke Hezbollah into further intervention there. And then who knows what. It's a good thing, but it means big changes for the future of the region and the different alliance systems, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think if anything, we might see Israel really try to provoke reactions from both Hezbollah and Hamas, which saying that, I mean, doesn't actually speak to what that would actually mean. Provoking a reaction would actually be murdering innocent people and doing far worse things than they already do in the occupied territories. So whether that's building more settlements, whether that's dropping bombs on families, whether that's firing upon fishing boats, all of this is going to continue. So I could certainly see Israel try to do something to kind of set something on fire in the meantime. But again, what just happened in Geneva, this is between six gigantic world powers and Iran. And this is unprecedented. This is a deal finally inked, signed with a photo op and handshakes and hugs in front of international press, in front of the entire world, with Barack Obama right. coming out at around 10:30 on a Saturday night before Thanksgiving and giving a statement to the press that's aired on national television, this is a different deal than anything before. And I think Israel is really sweating right now. I think AIPAC is really sweating right now. I think Foundation for the Defense of Democracy is that hilarious, ridiculous neocon think tank. I think they're really worried. They're going to fight back, but I think they're really worried right now.
Yeah, well, you're right. That's a very important point, what you say about it. This is not just a deal between the Americans and the Iranians. This is a deal between all the allies of World War II and the UN Security. Oh, and their archenemy, the UN Security
yeah,
Council plus Germany. So
they're
that's a pretty big
occupied.
Deal.
Yeah, of course. No, and I mean, beyond this, you know, so if we look to 10 years ago, the major negotiating partners were the EU3. So you had, you know, Britain, France, and Germany.
Right.
Negotiating primarily with Iran, and with the U.S. effectively being a spoiler under the Bush administration.
Well, and they were just trying to keep Dick Cheney at bay. They weren't trying to resolve anything.
Certainly, you know, but even so, the deal fell through because they wouldn't acknowledge Iran's right to enrich, and they also did, you know, reneged on a lot of their promises. But now you have the U.S. signing on, you have Russia signing on, you have China signing on, as well as these European powers. And you have, you know, you have a new administration in Iran, which has an excellent PR strategy, which effectively, I say that in the best possible way,
yeah.
To promote their own vision of diplomacy without any bombast, without any bluster. They are known in the West. They speak English, which apparently is very, very important for diplomacy to work in this Orientalist world of ours. They've been educated in the West. They have known a lot of their fellow diplomats for years and years and years. They've worked with them. This has really changed the tone. So even though the Iranian position has not really changed over the years, they still assert their right under the NPT to enrich uranium. They assert that they have full sovereignty over their own nuclear fuel cycle and for a peaceful nuclear energy program in their own country. They have been willing to have, you know, certain caps, certain limitations, certain inspections, all of this. All of this has not changed over the years. What has changed is who the diplomat saying it is, and that apparently has really worked out this time.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I'm always of the theory that just because some people want one doesn't mean that America or Israel or anybody really needs any enemies at all. And actually, this could be great for the Saudis too and for everybody. You know, why should we have to have Sunni-Shia civil war over there, which
no,
is
absolutely.
All really just
I mean,
political?
This really works out well for everyone. Obviously, as you said, elements in certain places, whether it's Washington, D.C., whether it's Tel Aviv, whether it's Riyadh, you know, this actually is a very positive outcome. This is a
well,
good
some of the Israeli generals
Israel.
Were saying so to the Christian Science Monitor that, you know, despite what Netanyahu thinks, we actually were considering it. And it occurred to us that, hey, why not have warmer relations with this former enemy state?
No, absolutely.
You know?
I mean, if the talking point has been for so long that a Iranian nuclear program that is close to having the capability, not the will or the intention, but just the capability, technically, to produce at least one nuclear weapon, if that then is no longer the case and it's internationally verified, that's a very positive thing for even Israeli warmongers. But the thing is, it's not really about that. It's all about hegemony in the region. It's all about if Iran has warmer relations and is able to freely trade, freely use their oil assets, freely conduct diplomacy. If this can all happen, it really undermines the Israeli position as this major military force in the region, as the only nuclear armed force, which is not going to change, unfortunately, for some time. And I don't mean that unfortunately because I think Iran's going to have a weapon. Quite the opposite. I think because Israel needs to be disarmed, and that I don't think is going to happen for a long while. But either way, Israel needs this military stranglehold and this diplomatic stranglehold with U.S. backing in the region to really remain a power that they are, and to act with impunity against the Palestinian people, and to undermine all international law and abrogate any known common human decency. I'm
opinion that their ability to do all that is bad for Israel, really. That they, it's good that they're limited in their actions, because they're destroying their own society, you know, for their own sake. They need an intervention.
And absolutely.
Just so happens it's in our interest to pursue one. All right, everybody, again, I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm talking with Nima Shirazi from Why to Sleep in America and Mufta.org. And now, so Nima, what are the Americans giving up? Because it seems like it's not nearly as much as the Iranians are in this one.
Well, no. It seems, for the time being, pretty limited. And both Obama and John Kerry have really stressed in their comments following the deal that these are not only limited concessions, but also temporary and reversible. So that, I think, is a way to kind of temper negative reactions to this, saying, hey, you know, we can flip these back on in an instant if we believe Iran is not complying with what the agreement is. And I think that's really kind of a hedge against all the negative reaction that they're sure to get, especially from Congress. The idea is certainly for all of the oil and banking sanctions for now, for the next 6 months, it has been guaranteed to Iran that there will be no new nuclear-related sanctions imposed on them, which really kind of puts a stop to certain efforts in Congress right now. There will not be any sanctions for 6 months. They're going to suspend certain sanctions on gold and precious metals. They're going to lift some sanctions on Iran's automobile industry and petrochemical exports. They're also going to free up billions of dollars of assets, which have been held in escrow, which are effectively Iran's money that has been held by foreign banks and not allowed to be repatriated, at least on paper. It is said that certain humanitarian transactions are going to be exempt from these sanctions, that the ability for Iran to purchase food and medicine and even agricultural commodities are going to be lifted. That will be facilitated through these, as well as there are going to be certain lifts on current bans for getting Iran better parts for airplanes to fix their very old aircraft. I mean, so lifting those, it's not a huge thing. It's still very limited sanctions relief, but hopefully it can set the stage for something much, much better in the future.
Yeah. And, you know, people ought to support the president on this one, you know, out loud, let their congressman know, participate to a degree, somehow write a letter to the editor, something, because this doesn't animate people as much as, say, for example, the threat of war with Syria got the entire American people up on their hind legs yelling, hell no, about that. Well, this is in support of peace, and we need that. It doesn't feel as much of an emergency. But, of course, America's relationship with Iran right now is everything. So,
a quick note about Syria. We were hearing months ago, obviously, that unless the U.S. bombed Syria, Iran would just be emboldened, and that then diplomacy would be totally impossible, because Iran would be totally unwilling to do anything that the U.S. says, because they would see the U.S. as a paper tiger, because the U.S. did not have the courage or the wherewithal to bomb Syria. And yet we see just how ridiculous that argument was today.
Yeah, well, Lindsey Graham says a lot of things, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm
exactly.
Sorry.
Lindsey Graham was actually on CNN Saturday night talking about the deal, and he actually had to ask Wolf Blitzer what the deal was before he could comment on it. But he was already on air. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, and of course he already knew what the answer was anyway. Whatever it is, I'm against it, because I want you to go to war. All right. Hey, thanks. We're way over time. Thanks so much for your time, Nima.
No problem, Scott. Thanks so much.
All right, everybody, that is a great Nima Shirazi from Why to Sleep in America and Mufta.org. That's it for Anti-War Radio this morning. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Scott Horton, here every Sunday from 8:30 to 9 on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. See you next week.